This is tape one, side two, Lawrence Henderson interview, August 28th, 1989. Do you recall how the idea of the project was broached to you when you were being recruited? How was it explained to you or described?
I don't recall that to amount to anything. I think I had a general sense of what they were trying to do, that this thing had been set up, and I knew Dave Griggs, you see, was a close personal friend of mine. I'd known him for many years and I worked with him in Europe. He said, you know, I'm running the Washington office. We'd like to have you come and run the Washington office for us. Just, you know, represent the contract, the project, generally. And so, at that point, as I say, I was not wildly interested in going back to the chemical bank. My interest had broadened a great deal, and although I had enjoyed working in the Latin American part of the bank, which was very different from just this conventional banking business, we had a lot of interesting experiences there. But I still didn't think that was really my dish of tea. And I had found this working with the military very interesting, and I had a lot of friends by then in the Air Force, and I thought, well, this Project RAND is a big thing for the Air Force, and maybe it'll work out. And you know, that's essentially the atmosphere that existed at the time. I didn't feel it, except for going to work for Douglas, which I knew nothing about. I didn't feel that I was. I felt I was in the same environment that I'd been in during the war. You see what I mean? In other words, the kind of thing that I expected RAND to be doing was the kind of thing I had been doing overseas during the war, but doing it in peacetime, in the planning area. That's the best way I can express it.
Okay.
And I remember though, I think it was that my experience in the bank and so on had been useful, because I remember the first time I went out to California to meet Arthur Raymond, he and I hit it off just fine. I mean, here's a guy who's an executive of an aircraft company, and I'd never met an executive of an aircraft company before. But of course, he was also a Bostonian. His father, you know, founded Raymond Whitcomb and so on. And we hit it off very well. Strangely enough, I had met Frank Kolbaum, of course, during the process, this process of trying to get Project RAND started, but in the whenever it was, the winter of 45 and the early spring of 46, I had met Frank Kolbaum then, and I guess I had met him at the radiation laboratory maybe once or twice before, so I knew who he was, but I'd never had any real close contact with him. But he obviously knew who I was, because when Dave Griggs suggested that I should succeed, Dave is the manager of the what was in the RAND office in Douglas, Frank said fine. He thought that would be fine. So,
when you took on this position, did you have any discussion with Ed Bowles about it?
Oh, I'm sure I must have, yeah. I don't remember.
Okay.
I'm sure I must have. I'm sure I talked to Jay Stratton about it at considerable length, because Jay, in a sense, I was working for Ed Bowles, but under Jay Stratton or with Jay Stratton. But Jay and I had gotten to be very good friends at that point, and I'm positive I consulted him, and I'm sure I must have consulted Ed Bowles. It must have been done with Ed Bowles' approval, because he was concerned about the relationship between the air staff and the new project RAND.
Right. What were the nature of your responsibilities or activities in this early period when the Washington office was first set in place?
Well,
what kinds of things did you find yourself doing?
Mainly telling the Air Force what we were doing, reporting to them, getting information from them. But this was a time when there was nobody really knew how Project RAND was going to be administered in the first place. There was a strong feeling on the part of a number of people, including especially Ed Bowles, that he didn't want Wright Field, which was, of course, the Air Force R&D outfit at the time, the major one, didn't want them managing RAND because he felt it was more an operational thing, just as I did, than just a technical thing. In other words, it was a conceptual planning function, and he didn't think that reporting to Wright Field would be right. So he was interested in getting people like Larry Norstad interested in it, which they were. And so I reported at that point. I reported to LeMay had been made head of research and development in the Pentagon, which everybody thought was very peculiar because he had no experience that way. And so I reported to him in terms of my contact with, quote, the customer, unquote, if you know what I mean.
Reported to him in what sense?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I really don't. I don't have any recollection of. You know, I would go see him. We would talk. He would ask me what we were doing. I would try to tell him what we were doing to the extent that I knew it. This was a time when we had all sorts of contacts with a lot of consultants involved in that first project. You know, a whole slew of them. You know, astronomers and social scientists, Paul Keshe Committee and Lyman Spitzer, to name a couple who were at the other, both ends of the spectrum. And I don't know, I would just kind of the representative there. I didn't know in detail what they were doing in Santa Monica. I would go out to Santa Monica, and more or less get briefed on what was going on and so forth. But you know, I knew roughly what they were working on and what they were trying to do, but I didn't have any idea what was going to come out at the other end. I couldn't visualize that report.
It sounds like you were in a similar position as in the wartime, in the sense that you were placed in a position where you had to convey something about technical information, the products of
Yes, that's right.
To people who were probably not as technically versed.
Sure. To some degree, that's true, sure. But most of the controversies that I got involved in, or the things that I was trying to fix and so on, were policy problems, not technical problems.
Okay. What were
management, in the sense of Wright Field's trying to tell you what to do, and I would say, no, that's not the idea. You know, that's not the way we work. And of course, this was anathema to a lot of the people at Wright Field, and it was not so to LeMay, who understood. He was just as antagonistic to Wright Field as we were, but he didn't know whether to trust us or not. It was kind of an interesting situation. Wright Field would come in and say, we want this new Project RAND with all the money they've got to do the following. And they would specify some stuff. He said, that's not the idea. We don't want you telling them. They're supposed to tell us. And, but then you never were quite sure what he meant by that. All you knew was that he was telling Wright Field to go peddle their papers and go somewhere else and so on. It was a very interesting time. And the Air Force didn't know what to make of this monster that had been created. Really, they just didn't have a clue.
Were you mentioned you were the conduit for RAND's activities to the Air Force. Was the conduit also in the reverse direction? Were you the principal point in which Air Force interests were conveyed back to RAND at that time?
Yeah, to a considerable degree, I think that's right, sure. I would tell them what LeMay was thinking or what he was saying and what Bowles was saying and so on, yeah. And there was this controversy between the Air Force and the Navy about who was going to run space and on and on. So all of that stuff was information that I conveyed back to Santa Monica as best I could, to the extent that I knew it.
But what was your sense then, I mean, of what the Air Force expectations were of RAND in this early period?
Well, I think at that point it was fairly clear to me, anyway, that at that stage of the game there was nothing monolithic about the Air Force's attitude toward RAND, because there were as many different attitudes as there were people with different backgrounds. I think it's different today, and it developed differently. But you didn't know what you were going to run into. And there were, well, I had friends, the Air Force Operations Analysis Office was still active at that point, and I had a lot of friends in there, and they were, of course, interested in, as they were then and are now, but at that point, the office, the Operations Analysis in the Pentagon was a fairly powerful part of the Air Staff. It isn't anymore. But at that point, they were independent, and they were interested in trying to improve Air Force planning and operations, just as we were in RAND. But there was never any real conflict between them and us. I don't really know why. I never could understand that very much. Well, I didn't worry about it because these guys were my friends, and we worked together, and we had worked together during the war, and we continued to work together.
Was their scope in some sense different than yours? Or?
Oh yeah, they were supposed to be doing a kind of operations research, which according to their notion, pretty much correctly, was how do you do better what you're doing now? Rather than we were trying to say, how do you figure out what you ought to be doing 10 years from now? Now that's a very different concept, different idea. But Roy Brothers, who got to be head of operations analysis, was a good friend, and there was remarkably little conflict there. The conflict we had was mostly with Wright Field and with the technical people, although there was some people there who were very sympathetic. Don Putt was always sympathetic. But there were other people. There was one general in particular who gave us a very hard time for a long period of time, and we wanted to avoid him. He fortunately never got promoted beyond major general, as I recall it.
Who are you referring to?
I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, we discuss it on the tape. I think the point is you want to know who. Who in the Air Force supported RAND and nurtured them, and those who attempted to make their lives difficult.
Well, as I say, chronology is very difficult for me. I can give you a list of the kind of people that supported RAND in the Air Staff, and that I thought were,
Well, that'd be marvelous.
And a lot of them were. It was over a period we developed a rapport with some of the people in the Air Staff that seemed to me to be the people who were really guiding the Air Force into the future, who were interested in the future, interested in improving the Air Force, and so on, and who, although parochial in a sense in their relations with the Army and the Navy, were not didn't have limited horizons in a general sense. Now, this is hard to express this, but a lot of the people in the planning business, there were some. Well, Norstad was outstanding. General Freddie Smith was a very, very outstanding guy in almost every way. I would find when it was necessary, which it wasn't very often, that I could go up and talk to the assistants, the colonels who were the aides and the assistants to the chief of staff, and invariably get support from them. They were always supportive of Rand and against whoever in the air staff was trying to give us a hard time. It's very interesting. I don't know why this should be so. Well, some of them went on. George Brown went on to become chief of staff and, I guess, chairman. Jim Sherrill and a fellow named Pat Paul, who was a great, great friend of Nate Twining's when Nate was chief of staff. Of course, I'd known Twining in Italy. He was the commander of the 15th Air Force, but he was never particularly friendly. But the people who worked for him were. You know, I don't think he didn't really understand Rand. Fine guy and all that, but some of these younger guys, who many of whom went on to bigger things, were very, very supportive. And then,
how do you assess that? Was it kind of a generational thing, or was
could have been? Yes, I think it was a generational thing. The people who had been senior colonels and junior generals in the war tended to be other generational. They're the people who grew up with the concept that the Air Force knew everything and was the right thing, and that everything was great, and that flying an airplane was the greatest thing since bottled beer, and, you know, that kind of thing. Some of them, however, had imagination, like Sailor Egan, who was the hottest pilot we had in Italy and later became a lieutenant general. Arthur C. Agan, A-G-A-N, Jr. He later went up in the air staff, and he was. I always got along with him very well, but I have a feeling that was more from personal friendship, having served in the same headquarters overseas, than it was with any idea that he really understood Rand or was. But a lot of this was a personal thing. But you could get. There was always somebody in the air staff that you could go to who would be sympathetic, even though it wasn't supposed to be his job to help you out. But he would. In other words, he would influence the upper echelon decision makers. And
This question of Air Force decision making is a very interesting one.
It's very interesting. Yeah,
touching on here, I think I'd like to put that off a little bit and perhaps use a couple of examples to pursue that.
All right.
But what you were saying was, in this very early period, it was more a matter of looking at issues of policy and organization.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Besides the right.
Who are we supposed to report to? How many reports a month should we make? You know, what should we report every month or every quarter or whatever it was? And how do we, if the Air Force has a question they want to ask us, how do they go about doing this? Do they give us a directive, or do they come to us and say, let's discuss this and see if you can help? Or, you know, all of that kind of thing is what was the main gist of what was going on, as I recall it. Now, that's still true to some degree.
Besides the issue of whether or not your principal line of reporting would be to right field or
yeah,
to the air
yeah,
staff.
Yeah, right.
Were there other major policy issues that you had to grapple with at this time?
Well, at that point, I don't think there was really any major policy issue about who do we send our reports to. For example, do we send them to the Army and Navy, and who else? You know, I don't think that didn't become an issue until later. Whether they liked us or not, whether they thought we were taking the right directives or not, whether we were in agreement with, quote, Air Force policy, unquote, whatever that might mean, technically or otherwise, I think they regarded us as part of them. We were in the family. They had us, you know, in a sense, under control, so they weren't worrying about our running end runs around them at that point. That came later.
Was there a number of ideas generated by the Air Force that they wanted to see RAND pursue at this time? I mean, RAND had the satellite study, which is a fairly
yeah.
major undertaking.
Yes,
Did the Air Force begin to get the hang of conveying its interests and needs to the organization? Or was it?
I don't know. I think there really wasn't anybody much in the air staff who would know what kind of a question to ask RAND. You know, they said, well, these guys are trying to think about the future, way out in the future, and I'm trying to figure out whether I can get approval for this airplane tomorrow or not in a meeting. And there wasn't much thinking there. Right field had been slapped down so much by LeMay and the people in the air staff that they got frustrated and didn't want to, first place, they didn't want to ask us anything because they were afraid they wouldn't be able to control it if they asked us something. And for example, give you an early example of this. Right after the end of the war, there was a lot of discussion about future materials. Metals and other materials that would be useful in the construction of aeronautical vehicles or space vehicles or what have you. And there was very little known about a lot of different materials, and so all the services were setting up different programs to have research done on materials. And in order to do this, I guess that Van Bush or somebody in the Research and Development Board decided that they ought to have an understanding that the Air Force would work on some and the Navy would work on some and the Army would work on some, and so they allocated these different materials. Well, as I recall it, in the early days, we decided at RAND that one of the things that we ought to do is to sponsor research on materials, particularly at Battelle Institute, which we did. We looked at various materials that we thought would be interesting, and one of the materials that we thought was not very interesting was a material that the Air Force was supposed to be working on, namely columbium. And we decided that wasn't interesting. Don't ask me why, but we thought it would be unlikely to be interesting. And we thought the titanium was very interesting, but titanium apparently had been assigned to the Navy, I guess. I'm not sure. I think so. So there was a big hoorah. Would it be proper for Project RAND to investigate titanium using Air Force money under an Air Force contract with a subcontract with Battelle, or whether that was... And the Navy protested, I believe. You can probably find a record of this somewhere. And we protested the other way. And, of course, the result is now that the the largest single piece of metal in the 747 airplane is an 18-ton titanium forging. And up to that point, nobody had ever seen any titanium except as a white powder in paint. And I still have, myself, a pair of the first forged titanium metal. It was a pair of dice, which we took in to show to the chief of the Air Force. Says, this is what you can do. These things had been made by hand, of course, at Battelle. And they're still absolutely beautiful. They're shiny, lovely. I've got them in a little glass case because I held on. We had several pairs made, and I kept a pair of this anyway. Anyway, the titanium project was eminently successful, and of course, it developed a whole industry. Now it's a very important construction material in aeronautics and other things too. But we were very much interested, of course, in that point about the strength-weight ratio and all that jazz. And but that was an example of a situation where there had been a joint Army-Navy-Air Force agreement, and we said, screw the agreement. We think that this thing, which has not been assigned to the Air Force, is more important than the things that have been assigned to, and we went ahead with it, and we got away with it. Don't ask me how or why. I mean, bureaucratically, they should have been able to stop us. But somebody put their foot down and said, no, let them do it. We'll take the rap, whatever the rap turned out to be. Well, it didn't, of course, because the thing was successful. But so there were things like that. There was a big hoorah about ramjets versus rockets, where the Air Force was interested in ramjets and the Army was interested, of course, with rocket because they had von Braun and all that bit. And so we said, that, well, that's nonsense, too. I mean, we ought to look at both of them. And
but to summarize, I think a part of what you were saying is that during this early period, the Air Force did not avail itself a great deal of the opportunity to ask RAND to conduct specific types of studies.
That's right. I think that's fair. It's fair to say that, right? I think it's mostly because they didn't quite know how to go about it. If they had been able to think about how to do this, they might have done more. Later on, they did, of course, and then they suggested all sorts of joint projects, none of which really were very good.
But in part, you chalk this up to the oddness of
exactly
into the future.
The oddness of a new organization that nobody had ever heard anything about. A new idea, a new way of conducting planning or research planning for the future. You know, people just didn't understand this. I don't know that we did either, but certainly the air staff for a long time didn't understand this, except for a very few exceptional individuals like Norstad, who understood it from the very beginning.
In this early period, I've had the opportunity to look at some of Ed Bowles' materials.
Yeah, right.
And soon after Project RAND got established, he seemed to become very disenchanted.
That's right.
With RAND.
That's right.
And
yes.
The progress it was making. And
that's right.
The way it was conducting its business. Did you have the opportunity to talk with him about his disenchantment or be aware of it in some other way?
Well, I was aware of it, and I didn't like it, and I didn't want to get into a big fight with Ed Bowles, so I kind of stayed away from it, as I recall it, as best I could. I didn't agree with his positions to the extent that I can remember them. I remember some of them. I thought that his criticisms were, on the whole, wrong. Ed was a curious guy. He was very imaginative and all that. But in a sense, at heart, he was a gadgeteer. We weren't inventing enough bright new gadgets for him. some of us thought that that, you know, it seemed to us that that was kind of A, too hard, and B, that if they wanted new gadgets, Wright Field could invent them or something of that sort. That, you know, you can say that the satellite was a gadget. Well, yes, in a sense, but it was a much broader kind of a more imaginative thing. And I don't know, you'd have to reread Ed Bowles' memos. I would have to reread them before I could recall exactly this. But there was a period of strain between Ed and myself. I just, you know, I thought that what we were doing was all right. I don't know why I thought so, but you know, I admired Arthur Raymond and Frank Kolbaum very much, and I thought that that Frank's judgment about how to run, what to do in RAND and how to run it was just remarkable, outstanding. Yeah. And the thing that I puzzled about it then, I didn't really puzzle about it very much at the time because I wasn't thinking in those terms, but as I look back on it now, I think to myself, the totally different background between Frank and myself, and we always hit it off. We never had a major disagreement about how to manage RAND or about what we were doing. It's crazy. I mean, I had this academic background from Harvard and all this European background in languages, and Frank was a fail-safe design engineer for Douglas, and a wonderful one, a very good one. We never had a disagreement. Very hard to understand. It was a wonderful relationship. As far as I was concerned, it was absolutely perfect because I would suggest something and he would say, fine, let's do it, you know, or he would tell me what to do and I'd say, that makes sense. And, you know, it was a very, I never had any real disagreements with Dick Goldstein, but he and I didn't speak the same language in that sense, in the way that Frank and I did. Frank, not being a terribly articulate guy, for some reason, we had no difficulty communicating. I don't know whether you asked Frank about this. It would be interesting if you did. But.
Yeah, Frank was very, in our interview, very laconic about relationships with other people.
Oh, yes, yes, very absolutely. Funny. That's his characteristic, of course, right?
Yes, yes.
I was, you know, curiously enough, on the few occasions when I really differed with Frank, it was because I thought he was being too lenient with some of these wild-eyed scientists who were rushing off in all directions at once and so on. I mean, you know, some of the ideas that John Williams had, which 90% of which were very, very good, but the other 10% were crazy. You know, every once in a while, Frank and I would have a difference of view on that, and Frank would take the position, well, you know, let's let him go hang himself. And so on, which was the right thing to do. In retrospect, I think all of his decisions along those lines were just very good. And I can't say too much about Frank. I think he was a very great man.
With getting back to Ed Bowles for a second, as I recall, two of his concerns, I think one was that the Donald Douglas, sort of as agreeing to take on Project RAND, was not giving the project sufficient top-level attention. And the other one was Bowles' concern that Frank Kolbaum was really not the best man to direct RAND.
That's right. Well, he was wrong on both counts, because the last thing you wanted was a lot of personal attention from the president of the aircraft company, for God's sake. I mean, Donald Douglas was a very fine man and a very able person, but the last thing that RAND needed was some supervision from an executive of an aircraft company. I mean, when we had this crazy council that we had with Claire Egvet and Dutch Kindleberger and Jack Northrop and Donald Douglas, you know, they never did anything except sit there and look like wise old owls while we told them what we were doing. And fortunately, they never told us, you know, what to do and what not to do, which was very good. I think actually that's largely due to the fact that all of them respected Arthur Raymond, and Donald Douglas said, to himself, well, look, why should I get involved in this damn thing? Let Ray handle it. You know, it's my feeling. And but it was a very interesting experience. Anybody who met Dutch Kindleberger would know what I mean. And Jack Northrop was just a very sweet guy and very bright, and I hope to God the B-2 survives, because that was his idea, of course, the flying wing. He invented it, and whether it'll survive or whether it's viable, I don't know. But a lot of us thought that this was a very, very interesting idea, and more or less supported the idea from the outset. Not that we necessarily thought the B-35 or the B-49 were great things, but Jack was a very imaginative guy. And of course, all of these guys worked together. They worked for Douglas before they worked for themselves. Kindleberger, Northrop, you name it.
So your recollection of this advisory group
Advisory Council or whatever it was called. Yeah, the RAND Advisory Council.
They played kind of a titular role.
Oh, sure. No, we briefed them just the way we would brief the air staff. But we didn't expect to have them tell us what to do any more than we expected the air staff to tell us what to do.
What was the nature of your contact with Arthur Raymond as the project was getting established?
Well, I went out and met him and got to know him, and we got to be friends, and it seemed to me that, you know, I was working for Frank Kolbaum, basically. And we were both working for Ray, but Frank had a very good relationship with Arthur Raymond. And again, although they were both engineers, they were very different types, had very different interests outside of business. But they got along just very well. The whole thing was a very good relationship. Maybe I'm exaggerating this and so on, but I thought that the combination of Arthur Raymond and Frank Kolbaum and Rowan Gaither and the trustees that we got was just a great, great thing. And that I think we did do a lot of good, but you know, you always wonder whether you could have done more. But I have a sense of satisfaction from what I did over the years at RAND, and the sense of feeling that RAND is a remarkable organization and that I had something to do with it.
One of the reasons I asked about Arthur Raymond is that he kind of stood outside the organization. I mean,
that's right.
Frank was the director.
That's correct. He didn't interfere with Frank. That's right.
So I'm a little unclear on precisely what his role was. I sort of gave the impression he was kind of a father figure, in a sense.
That's right. That's right, yeah. No, this is right. But, it didn't seem to me that he tried to steer RAND in any important sense, that he let Frank have his head pretty much. And he was responsible to Mr. Douglas for running the Douglas Company, and we stole all sorts of very talented people from the rest of Douglas at the beginning. I mean, people like Gene Root and Jimmy Lipp, and you know, these were Goldie, these were very key people in the Douglas Engineering Department. Now, we knew we could never get our hands on Ed Heineman, who was the guy that made the Douglas military part go, because he was the Navy designer, chief engineer for El Segundo. We knew we could never get him, and we knew we could never get Carlos Wood, who was their top aerodynamicist, who was I got to know these people, you know, incidentally, as part of RAND, because I, you know, after all, you couldn't help getting to know them when you're out at Douglas. But
Maybe we can talk a little bit then about the transition to the corporation and some of the issues that led up to Project RAND spinning off from Douglas.
Yeah, well, I think the principal issue was that there was some sniping from industry. I think Dutch Kindleberger was not all that sympathetic. I don't recall whether the people at Lockheed, the grosses or anybody there, made much of a noise. But I think Dutch Kindleberger didn't particularly like it. And then Donald Douglas began to worry about whether it was interfering with Douglas, because he had the feeling that the antagonism between the engineering people in the Air Force and Wright Field and RAND was doing great harm to Douglas, that they were being shortchanged in their bid proposals and so on because of the existence of RAND. So he wanted to get rid of RAND. He was very strongly wanted to get rid of RAND. He wasn't antagonistic to the idea, I don't think, but he felt that this is not doing the Douglas Company any good. And we're getting the Air Force, the people in the Air Force that we have to deal with are the ones who don't like RAND, who want to control RAND, and they can't control RAND because the other people in the Air Force have told them not to. And that's doing Douglas a great deal of harm. And there was a very strong feeling, I think, in that direction. I don't mean there was a personal feeling. I'd never known how Arthur Raymond felt about that, whether he felt that was, but I don't really think so. I think it was Mr. Douglas personally who felt that way. I don't mean that, I don't never sense that there was any real conflict between Mr. Douglas and Raymond and Frank or RAND, but he just felt that, no, this animal we don't want. It's doing us harm in our main business, which is selling airplanes or rockets or what have you. And so there was a strong feeling along those lines. Whether he was exaggerating this, whether he felt that his competitors were gaining a real advantage against him on account of it, whether he felt that it was just that the Air Force was prejudiced, or whether, I don't know. I just don't know. But I have the feeling that this was really a very strong motivation, and that it became obvious. It was obvious to a lot of the rest of us who were not associated with the aircraft industry or with Douglas or anything like that this thing ought to be independent anyway. I mean, why are you doing? When you talk to academic people that come on the outside, you know, why are you? What the hell is Douglas Aircraft Company doing? You're talking about this wonderful project. You want us to come and work with you on the sociology of the Soviet military or something like that. You know, well, what the hell has this got to do with the Douglas Aircraft Company? See, so there was a general feeling on the outside, including on my part too, that it would be a lot better if we could get separated from Douglas. I was never really concerned about the fact that, you know, I'm working for Douglas. What the hell does that mean? That never really bothered me much. But it was obvious that in talking with people on the outside, particularly in the academic world, as opposed to this competitive problem in the industry, that talking to people on the outside, it was obvious that it ought to be divorced from the project should be divorced from Douglas.
Okay, let me just pause here at the end of the tape.
Right.